The Guardian.
Let us be clear, we are no longer talking here about politicians and celebrities. We're talking about murder victims, potentially terrorist victims, having their phones hacked into. It is absolutely disgusting at what has taken place, and I think everyone in this House, and indeed this country, will be revolted by what they've heard and what they've seen on their television screens.
Stakes are high, tempers are heated, and reputations hang in the balance. This is Politics Weekly with me, Tom Clark, and what a week it's been since the revelation that the News of the World hacked a young murder victim's phone. Joining me to ask how it happened and what on earth happens next, I have in the studio the Guardian columnists Julian Glover and Anne Perkins, and also the Observer's political editor, Toby Helm. A warm welcome to you all. Until this week, calling for a full inquiry into the extent of phone hacking at the News of the World was a very much a minority pursuit. Taking on News International, the Metropolitan Police and the Press Complaints Commission often felt like a rather lonely job to those of us here at Guardian Towers. But the revelation this week about Millie Dowler and other murder victims as well, today we read of soldiers having their phones tapped, was actually the culmination of work that had gone all the way back to 2009, and the reporter who got the ball rolling was the Guardian's very own special correspondent, Nick Davis. He spoke to me earlier and gave us a brief history of how we got to here.
Well, we started off with an official version of events according to which one rogue reporter and one private investigator had hacked the phones of a grand total of 8 people. And that was it. That was the entire story. About 2 years ago, we did a big investigation which showed basically that that was a lot of old nonsense, that the police who had originally investigated the case had got evidence which indicated to them that there were, quote, thousands of victims, and that amongst that they had evidence that a particular man, Gordon Taylor, from the Professional Footballers Association, had been a victim, and Gordon Taylor had sued them and been paid hundreds of thousands of pounds to stay quiet and not mention it to anybody. Well, now, at that stage, when we published that story, News International attacked us ferociously. They used all 4 of their newspapers in this country and also Sky Television to accuse us of lying to the British people. And that meant, therefore, that not only was our story being marginalised, but our credibility was at stake. So we persisted. And slowly, as the months went by, we dragged out more evidence, sometimes from journalists who'd worked for the News of the World, sometimes by using the Freedom of Information Act to extract information from the police. Sometimes it was because public figures started to sue and their lawyers managed to extract evidence with court orders, forcing the police or News International to disclose material. And slowly, slowly, we've pushed it and pushed it, like pushing a great boulder up a hill. And after about 18 months, we broke through and reached a point where, in January of this year, News International had to put their hands up and say, it's true, we admit all this stuff was going on. They're still lying. They still like to pretend that they didn't realize it was going on at the time, which is another one of their lies. But we've come a very long way since they were attacking us and trying to rub us out.
Ed Miliband's been calling for Rebecca Brooks, the chief executive of News International, to stand down. David Cameron's just been talking in relatively vague terms about a public inquiry. Can I just ask you, what should happen next and what will?
I think it's probably got to go to a public inquiry. The police inquiry, Operation Wheating, which is being run by Scotland Yard, which is finally doing the job properly after years of failure, can't take on the full scale of everything that's involved here. If you start to look at all of the different newspapers who were breaking the law, all of the different ways in which they were breaking the law, they were using Trojan emails, you know, to get into people's computers. They were hacking live phone calls. They were occasionally setting up burglaries. And if you think of all the different private investigators and all the different newspapers who are involved, it's too much for Scotland Yard's Operation Wheating.
But, I mean, that's just the inquiry side. There's also a rather important business decision in the air at the moment.
Yes, on B Sky B, clearly, there's a furore in the House of Commons about the possibility that that News International might take over all of B Sky B. And I mean, I don't understand all the legal ramifications of it or how the Competition Commission fits in, but at a basic gut level, there's something pretty worrying about a group which is already so powerful that it acts as though it were above the law, then becoming still more powerful by taking over a great big television network like that. And I think an awful lot of people in this country will just think, enough, these people have got enough power, they've already probably got too much power, time for that to stop.
Julian, why is it that this is such a political story rather than just another media story?
Well, it's a political story for two reasons. One is the decision of the takeover of B Sky B, which in the end is a political decision, and the government is a long way down the track of allowing. But more than that, it's a political story because David Cameron, in opposition, hired the former editor of the News of the World, Andy Coulson, who I know, I quite like Andy Coulson. He seemed a reasonable guy. David Cameron thought he'd do the job well. He did do the job well. He was extremely close to Cameron. He wasn't just a spin doctor who'd brief out the line. He was in the meetings. He gave advice to Cameron and to Osborne about what to do. Then, at the election, he went into Downing Street, and that was perhaps unexpected. It was certainly controversial inside the Cameron circle. Many people close to Cameron thought that was wrong.
Because there was already...
Partly because of the style of his operation, and partly because there was all his stories around. As Nick Davis has said in that interview, this has been around for a long time. Andy Coulson has resigned, well, now twice over this. So although the scale and the nature of the victims is new this week and has created the shock this week, the basic fact that the News of the World was doing this kind of thing has been well known for a long time and was known when Cameron hired Coulson. It ties Cameron very closely to it. Added to that, there's a circle of people in Oxfordshire who go out to dinner parties with each other, and that can include David Cameron and Rebecca Brooks. So he socially meets these people, and he's employed the people who did this or oversaw it being done. Now, it's true that other politicians caught the News of the World and caught the media too. Ed Miliband goes to News International's parties, and no doubt he's a friend of Rebecca Brooks, or might one day have become one, Prime Minister and she survived. But Cameron is really close to all of this, and he's in a real bind.
Toby, do you think maybe Mr Cameron hadn't been reading his Guardian? Do you think he could have just accepted the reassurances of Andy Coulson and taken them at face value?
Well, that's clearly what he did. I mean, one of the charges against Cameron since he became Prime Minister is that he makes a judgment about people, whether it be, you know, Andrew Lansley and his health reforms or other people, and then sticks to it until it's proved to be wrong. But he does it on instinct without going thoroughly enough into things. And in terms of the appointment of Andy Coulson, it was on the advice of George Osborne. So Cameron's taking, if you like, second-hand advice and sticking by him, and Coulson did a good job for him. Cameron never chose to doubt Coulson's integrity, it seems to me, and I don't think that was, you know, clearly that wasn't Cameron sort of acting in bad faith. I think it was Cameron acting in good faith, but it does tell you a lot about Cameron, the fact that he didn't ask more questions about Andy Coulson.
I mean, it's striking, Anne, isn't it? When he first appointed him back in 2007 or whenever it was, there was this line about, well, I believe everyone deserves a second chance, and this guy has already fessed up to being in charge of a rotten ship at the News of the World. By 2010, when he made the fresh decision to appoint him to Downing Street, The Guardian had already run an awful lot of material that implicated him pretty heavily, hadn't it?
I think there's two interesting aspects of this. One, I think it's important to remember that back in the days of the leadership contest for the Tory party, News International didn't like Cameron. They thought he was lightweight. They much preferred David Davis. They felt he was much more their kind of man. So Cameron always knew he had ground to make up at News International, and that would have perhaps just lent an edge to Coulson as a candidate. And then, as Toby and Julian have said, he did do the job very well. The other aspect of this, which is very hard to understand from what you call Guardian Towers, is how people on the right of politics think the Guardian is a kind of left-wing conspiracy. And I think they found it, what I hope they now realise is wrongly and embarrassingly wrongly easy to discount what the Guardian was doing. And I think that was also an important consideration.
Think there's anything of that, Julian?
Yes, I think there is. I think at times it looked as though the Guardian was obsessing about this story. You know, at times to me it felt like the Guardian was obsessing about this story, and it's a salutary lesson for me as much as anyone else. Occasionally, the Guardian picks up issues and persists with them over years, and we did it with BAE as well, where at times you wondered why we were running yet another story about BAE, and it turned out it was a really important story to run, and it did expose something. I think the same feeling happened over this. It's also true, of course, that lots of other newspapers didn't pick the story up. And One of the things for me that matters, and we may come onto it in this discussion, is that whilst at the moment it is a News International crisis, and in brackets I should declare an interest, my partner works for News International, it is a News International crisis, and maybe it's worse there than anywhere else, and it links directly to Downing Street, it's also a crisis for other bits of the media. The Guardian
certainly
did not,
all quiet until
the Guardian did not do this. I don't know what other newspapers did and didn't. And if we're going to have a public inquiry, it better focus on the whole media and not just try and target News International, because the one thing that worries me about the story and the one thing that worried me about the debate yesterday was a little edge of just getting a bit of revenge against News International, whilst I didn't hear many Labour MPs talk about the Daily Mirror. I didn't hear anybody mention the Daily Mail. Now, maybe they didn't do it, but I'd be quite surprised.
But that's absolutely right, isn't it, Toby, listening to the debate yesterday? It was very slanted against News International, but you're not surprised in a way in that it has this extraordinary privileged reach into the establishment. I mean, you're seeing with the other, you know, the fact that he was having Christmas drinks with, Prime Minister was having Christmas drinks with Rebecca Brooks, the fact that the police seem to have held their punches to the extent they did. Is it in a unique position, even if its skullduggery isn't unique?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head. I mean, yesterday at Prime Minister's Questions, you had this extraordinary sight of Ed Miliband switching fences and switching sides and basically and calling quite clearly for Rebecca Wade's head. David Cameron was unable to do so. And there you'd had the most kind of heinous crime that could be committed in media terms with Millie Dowler. And yet Cameron felt boxed in to somehow stop short of calling for Rebecca Wade's head.
Of course,
now,
for a Prime Minister.
That shows just the extent to which the Murdoch empire has sort of crept into every corner of the establishment, right up to, prime ministerial level.
Indeed, and I mean, Ed Miliband's spin doctor is a former Murdoch employee too. And one of the things that Ed Miliband has wanted to do is exactly what Anne says, is to win over News International, because he felt he was not getting his market.
Yeah, and Baldwin's first acts as spin doctor under Ed Miliband, actually, was to send a letter to all MPs saying, don't isolate News International.
Yeah, and keep the takeover separate from the...
Which was a good point, as Julian says, but it was also a point that was very sensitive to, showed the sensitivity to offending Murdoch.
And the benefit for Miliband of that kind of thing is that in recent weeks, the Sun has been backing him on crime is tougher than the government, and it's one reason we saw that terrible retreat on sentencing policy, because Labour was getting a bit of inroads into the Sun.
I think the key point here, though, is have we now reached the tipping point in which people will, if you like, want of a better phrase, suck up to Murdoch? Or have we reached a point where Murdoch has somehow become toxic? Yeah. You know, it's the Westminster Party question. Will people want to be seen at a Westminster Party with Rupert Murdoch and his mates or not? And I think we've crossed that point.
And is it like going out for drinks with Fred Goodwin now, do you think, to go out and have a glass of wine with Rebecca Brooks?
Well, I bet she's got some very loyal friends. And
some very good wine as well.
And probably some very good wine. I mean, Toby may, I'm sure, as the summer party season reaches its peak, people will be addressing this this issue with care. I think the kind of curious thing is to go back to the silence of the other newspapers who we know also, we're pretty sure, have also been involved in some pretty low, not to say illegal, tactics. And it's really is inappropriate to view this entirely in isolation. It is so much also a part of the bigger picture about the problem that the newspaper industry faces.
Yes, and I mean, on that, I think one of the consequences of it might be, to answer the party question, that News International, before or after Rupert Murdoch stops running it, which won't be that far away, will decide that the problem in this business is newspapers. Newspapers are not particularly profitable. Some of them are terribly loss-making. And News International will escape this problem, not by kind of digging out the newspapers and rescuing them and sorting out their practices, but just by dumping them and retaining Sky, trying to buy the whole of Sky, get rid of the Times, sell it to a Russian oligarch or a Qatari billionaire, get rid of the News of the World. And then we'll suddenly think, God, is that any better? This may have consequences, and it's started with News International, with The Guardian pursuing it, but it may have consequences which over time are pretty nasty.
But Julian, picking up what you said about this is obviously a wider problem, everyone's acknowledged that. If it had been, for example, the Daily Mail,
that was in this up to its neck in quite the way at the moment that the News of the World is. Do you think that the Prime Minister would have been going easy on calls for resignations there in the way that he felt obliged to in News International? Or do you think it's special?
There's too many hypotheticals in that, really, to answer it, because we haven't yet seen what the Daily Mail might have been doing. And I think the paper that's
is
the Mirror and the Sunday Mirror, who had to compete with the News of the World and the Sun and probably do so on a lower editorial budget. And I suspect quite a lot went on there. And you did not hear Labour MPs talk about the Mirror yesterday, and that could be a big problem in the next few months, because we will find that all politics is connected to these people. It isn't just a kind of News International Coulson problem. I do think on resignations, I mean, there's two things you do in Britain whenever there's a problem. One is you call for an inquiry. You haven't quite looked at what kind of inquiry, and then you have a debate about what kind of inquiry. And the other thing you do is call for some resignations. It's a sort of tradition in every crisis, possibly a good tradition. So at the moment, everyone's rushing around wanting someone to resign. And, you know, I think Rebecca Brooks will and should go, and wanting an inquiry. And there should be one, but we don't know what kind yet. As for the Daily Mail, well, wait and see.
Well, let's just turn for a moment and listen to Ed Miliband yesterday.
With the biggest press scandal in modern times getting worse by the day, I'm afraid he hasn't shown the leadership necessary today. He hasn't shown the leadership necessary on BSkyB. He hasn't shown the leadership necessary on News International. And isn't it the case, if the public is to have confidence in him, he's got to come at the thing that is most difficult. He's got to accept that he made a catastrophic error of judgment by bringing Andy Coulson into the heart of his Downing Street machine.
Easy cheers there, Anne, from the Labour benches. It's some people say it's not since Neil Kinnock, some people say it's not since Michael Foot that a Labour leader went to war openly with Rupert Murdoch. Do you think this could be short-term game for long-term pain for Ed Miliband?
I think he couldn't do anything else yesterday. I think he absolutely had to do it. Quite how Tom Baldwin
signed it off.
I don't know, but except that I think that, you know, he's a very sharp operator, and he would have understood quite how bad it's got. And I was just reading, you know, some of the things that Guardian readers have been writing, but beneath the story today. And I mean, I've just never seen people so kind of incensed with the substance of a story. You know, it's really kind of touched a public nerve that it's kind of easy to overlook when you're in the business yourself. I don't think Ed Miliband had a choice. And I think politicians overrate how influential newspapers are. Mm. I think there's a big appetite for politicians to stand separately from newspapers, to be much more, to name one of my heroes, Baldwin-esque about it. And
not Tom.
Stan, not Tom. And to, you know, make it clear that they're much more concerned about the substance of what they say than with how well it will play on the front pages of the Daily Mail or of the Sun or of the Times.
Now, Toby, if you ask the British public in an opinion poll, should the politicians stand up to the newspapers, of course they're going to say yes, and many of them would agree with what Anne's just said. But the trouble for politicians, isn't it, is that the public only learn about what they get up to through the media. And so do you think, you know, once this is all forgotten, Ed Miliband will be paying a price?
I don't. I think he's got this one right, actually. I mean, I think if you think about what his spin doctor, ex-News International man Tom Baldwin, would have been thinking, he would have been thinking 3 weeks, 4 weeks ago, you know, this was still an argument principally between politicians and The Guardian. It was in the kind of high realms of, you know, media politics. Suddenly, this week it became a story about a little murdered girl's mobile phone. Mm. And the bonfire of public opinion is kind of raging at that. People can really, really feel it. People are very angry at all levels. The public, you know, the public are absolutely incensed by this. And I think at the weekend you'll see the News of the World, you know, being boycotted by numerous people. I think you'll see an existential threat to the News of the World, actually, possibly. And I think he's got it right for that reason. I think at some point he had to make a stand. He had to show he was a leader who believed in something. That's the charge against him, that he doesn't believe in very much at the moment. This appeared like it was coming from the heart, and I think it was also politically well judged.
Yeah, that's completely correct. One of the difficulties, though, is this is a sort of rage which is both justified and very hard to know where it will lead, except to the sort of corrosion of public life. We had the same thing with expenses. We've had it in a different way with super injunctions. We've had a lot of public
disquiet. There's an air of revenge in it, isn't there?
And I'm not complaining about it because I think it's in many ways justified. The public don't trust the people who run the country. They don't trust people who write about the people who run the country. They want change. They don't know how to have change. We don't know how to have change. I mean, one of the difficulties for The Guardian, too, is we've exposed a great disaster, a great horror. We haven't got a clear answer as to how to fix it. One can say we need better regulation, but then we start straying into rather scary areas, and areas that in different circumstances might restrict the press. Now, I want to stop the press intruding into people's mobile phones and writing about their sex lives. I don't want to stop them writing about, as I mentioned earlier, BAE. It's very hard to know what kind of model we want for the media next. Added to that, as you mentioned before, the huge shift into social media and digital media, the way that newspapers themselves are beginning to disappear. We don't know what's going to emerge from this. I'm not sure it's going to be a better world. It may be a world in which loads of people tweet gossip about everybody, completely unregulated, probably even more inaccurate than the News of the World's stolen gossip. It could be quite a horrible future. I don't know that this is going to lead to the cleaning up of the media.
Although it would be a more dispersed system of power, wouldn't it, than we're used to. I mean, one thing that's been fun this week looking on Twitter, Toby, is to see Rebecca Brooks kind of trending in a way that she would never have been making front page news in the Murdoch press. So it's like Julian says, it's a rage. It might be hard to control, but at least everyone's entitled to their own bit of rage.
Yeah, and I think that adds to the danger for News of the World, because then Murdoch, because people are becoming very involved in the story themselves. They have a sort of power over it and an involvement over it. And in a way, that's also what's interesting about this week, a story that had been kind of, as I said, kind of rather complicated and institutional and sort of Westminsterish to the wider public, suddenly has a kind of connection with ordinary people's lives, and they can be taking part of it, as you say, through Twitter, through Facebook, through boycotting their News of the World. You know, everybody has a part of it.
I think that's possibly true. We don't yet fully know how much it's connected with people. It's certainly connected with the media around the world. It's on the fronts of newspapers. It's on radio stations all over the place.
I think if you've, but everybody talks about it wherever you go at the moment. So,
non-political people.
I think there's a high chance it will end up like MPs' expenses. It did become the thing everybody talked about and totally transformed the way people saw politicians. I'm not certain we're there yet. I don't know that people trusted tabloid journalists before either. And perhaps we had a slightly more noble view of our own profession than the public did, even before this began.
I don't think people trusted politicians either. I think the kind of real crisis that this might provoke or might consolidate is this sense of distance between the ruling establishment and everybody else. Curiously, the very establishment that, you know, the News of the World, the very kind of establishment that the News of the World appeared to dislike and tried to present itself as being against.
Yes, and that's one of the things that's shocking, is that was the People's Paper, and that's why this is such a story. This is the paper that was on the side of the squaddy when the politician couldn't be bothered, and the squaddies all thought it, or they thought the Sun was, and then they discover it's tapping their phones. I think there's a huge gap, and there always will be a gap between the media and the nature of the country. I mean, there's a tense gap between The Guardian and most of Britain. Now, we have a view of how we'd like Britain, and if you read The Guardian, it's a very noble one, and we'll try and spread it across the country. It ain't how Britain is. The News of the World perhaps was a bit closer at times, but now that emerges as fake too. It's horrible.
Oh dear. Well, Ned, let's just finally turn, Toby, to the coalition and whether there's going to be cracks in that as a result of that, as a result of these stories. We know that Vince Cable, because he told The Telegraph undercover for us, was going to pull the plug on the B Sky B merger with Murdoch's Empire. We know that Jeremy Hunt was minded not to. There's a real divergence, isn't there, in between the two parties and how they think of Murdoch?
There certainly is, yeah. And I think what's interesting is the Lib Dems are very much in the mode of causing trouble for the coalition in a kind of way that they want to be seen as asserting their identity within the coalition. And this is a very, very good opportunity for them to do that. But again, you come back to the risk for them. I mean, they are a party now polling at 8%. They have a great short-term interest in saying, we think Murdoch's, you know, awful, you know, everything about the Murdoch Empire is dreadful. But if they do that, and this passes, as, you know, maybe Julian's right, maybe it will, then, you know, the Lib Dems have a bit of a problem.
But, I mean, the Murdoch really has never given the Lib Dems a fair crack of the whip at any point. Well,
that's a lovely idea that Murdoch would have spent any time thinking about the existence of the Lib Dems at all. No, I think the Lib Dems don't like Murdoch. Clearly, they don't really like the media, actually. Lib Dems generally hate all newspapers, maybe not The Observer, but they certainly hate The Guardian at the moment, too. They just feel the press doesn't understand them and doesn't give them a fair crack of the whip, as you say. What do they do? Well, it's very hard for Clegg to sort of burst out and say he totally disagrees with David Cameron. He's clearly just trying to lead slightly sharper than Cameron is. And so when Cameron says he wants an inquiry, Clegg will say he wants a particularly special judicial inquiry. I think that's all they can do.
But I think that was a smart... I don't quite understand why Cameron's havering about the nature of the inquiry. I think it's perfectly straightforward. It needs to be a judge-led inquiry, and good on the Lib Dems for actually, you know, getting out there and out with it. And
straightforward for you, Anne, but not necessarily for David Cameron.
Well, of course, we could always hire Ken MacDonald to do it, as seems to be...
You have to get the right judge in these inquiries, like Hutton inquiry proved.
Exactly. You know, they're just going through the list of judges at
quite a lot of research, I suspect.
And it is true that if you're the Prime Minister, not to defend it, but if you're the Prime Minister, the Leader of the Opposition can say a lot of things and they don't have to happen. The Prime Minister has got to say something that then can happen and happen properly. They should have planned for an inquiry long before. They're probably desperately doing it today. I can understand why he didn't just announce the exact details at PMQs. He would have made it up on the hoof. And then later we would all say, why did he leap into this and not spend a few days thinking about what's the best kind of inquiry?
I wonder. Well, I'll leave it to our listeners to judge whether they think that David Cameron's merely playing for time while he gets the details right, or whether he might still think he's got something to hide. You can have your say on our blog at guardian.co.uk/politicsweekly. And you can follow all the latest twists and turns on Andy Sparrow live blog throughout the days ahead. My thanks to Julian Glover, to Toby Helm and to Anne Perkins. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.